Enfin, j'ai le grand plaisir d'accueillir comme professeur invité Roger Bagnall, professeur émérite à l'Université de New York, dont la venue a été repoussée 2 années de suite à cause de la situation sanitaire. Alors, ce report a au moins un avantage, c'est celui de placer l'année 2022 au Collège de France un peu plus sous le signe de l'Égypte. Les 4 conférences que mon invité s'apprête à donner précède de 2 mois et demi le Congrès international de papyrologie qui se tiendra ici même, réunissant pendant la dernière semaine de juillet toute la communauté des papyrologues, ou une partie de la communauté des papyrologues. On attend environ 400 personnes, sans compter évidemment l'exposition sur Champollion qui aura lieu en septembre-octobre avec son cortège de conférences, de manifestations. Je ne vous en révèle pas le secret pour vous laisser savourer l'attente. Évidemment, ce sont des manifestations auxquelles vous êtes tous invités et qui fêteront le bicentenaire du déchiffrement des hiéroglyphes. Alors, ce programme, assez riche et multiforme, donnera la possibilité de visiter des pans très différents, très variés de l'Égypte, depuis l'époque pharaonique jusqu'à l'époque arabe. Et en attendant, eh bien, c'est un aspect très important de l'Égypte romaine antique, de l'Égypte romaine et antique tardive, auquel nous convie Roger Bagnall à travers ses 4 conférences consacrées au management économique, j'emploie un mot anglais, je suis désolé en français, de l'Égypte romano-byzantine. Alors, ce serait presque faire offense à notre invité que de le présenter, tant son œuvre est importante par le volume, mais aussi par le contenu. Je vais malgré tout le faire, non pour me soumettre à la rhétorique de la prétérition, mais pour nos auditeurs les plus jeunes, il y en a un certain nombre dans la salle, qui n'ont peut-être pas lu tous les ouvrages de Roger Bagnall. Ils auront d'ailleurs du mal à le faire d'ici la fin du cycle de conférences, car Roger a en effet écrit presque une 50aine d'ouvrages et environ 300 articles. Ces publications font de lui une des personnalités les plus complètes et les plus marquantes de la papyrologie moderne, papyrologie qu'il a concouru, et je n'ai pas peur des mots, à façonner. Il est en effet, comme vous le savez, un éditeur de textes qui n'hésite pas à se frotter à la documentation inédite. Il a publié les ostracas du Royal Ontario Museum d'Amsterdam, de Ley, de Floride, se trouvait plus récemment à Bérénike. Il a publié 3 volumes des papyrus de Columbia. Il a édité le très intéressant livre de contes de Kélis sur tablette, les archives des nécrotaphes de la Grande Oasis, un registre fiscal d'Hermopolis du VIe siècle sur papyrus. Mais son activité d'éditeur, il l'a toujours conçue comme au service de l'analyse et de la synthèse historique, et on lui doit de ce point de vue quelques modèles du genre, comme son Egypt in Late Antiquity de 1993, ou plus récemment son Early Christian Books in Egypt de 2009, qui connut aussi d'ailleurs, je le dis pour les francophones qui sont ici, une version française qui correspond aux conférences qu'il a données à Paris en 2006, hein, Livre chrétien antique d'Égypte. Alors, cette connexion étroite entre l'activité éditoriale du papyrologue et son questionnement historique, eh bien, il l'a bien mise en valeur dans un livre, disons, à portée méthodologique et épistémologique, « Reading Papyri, Writing Ancient History » de 1995. Et depuis 2001, il a ajouté une 3e casquette, celle de l'homme de terrain, puisqu'il dirige les fouilles archéologiques à Hameida, dans les oasis, fouilles qui se sont fait remarquer non seulement par les résultats spectaculaires qu'elles ont livrés, mais aussi, et c'est un fait peut-être qu'il faut suffisamment rare, disons, dans le monde de l'archéologie pour qu'il soit souligné, par la publication rapide et régulière des documents exhumés. Le 3e volume des ostracas découverts sur le site est sorti en 2016. Je ne sais pas s'il y a un autre volume qui est en cours.
En cours.
Il y a un autre volume en cours. Alors, complet, Roger Bagnall est aussi par l'ampleur des périodes qu'il couvre. Hein. Il a commencé par s'intéresser à l'époque hellénistique avec un ouvrage de 1967, « The Administration of the Ptolemaic Possessions Outside Egypt », Puis c'est Greek Historical Documents, the Hellenistic Periods, 1981. Il a écrit ensuite avec son collègue Freer un ouvrage de référence sur la démographie de l'Égypte romaine en 1994, où il utilise des modèles démographiques modernes pour reconstituer la démographie antique. Et justement, Bagnall est effectivement un de ces historiens qui, parmi les premiers, ont utilisé les méthodes d'analyse et de quantification développées par la science moderne. Enfin, depuis de nombreuses années, il se consacre, on va dire, peut-être principalement à l'Égypte byzantine, en ne se restreignant pas à une vision helléno-centriste, celle justement des papyrologues de jadis, mais en prenant aussi en considération la documentation copte, la documentation arabe, et aussi en replaçant toujours l'Égypte dans un contexte beaucoup plus large, comme en témoigne par exemple son ouvrage « Everyday Writing in the Greco-Roman East » de 2010. Donc c'est à cette conception globale, cette conception transdisciplinaire, qu'il a lancé d'ailleurs à une époque où la transdisciplinarité n'était pas encore devenue une injonction de la recherche, que Roger Bagnall doit être devenu une personnalité marquante, non seulement de la papyrologie, mais aussi de l'histoire ancienne. Mais pas seulement, il a doté les études papyrologiques historiques d'instruments dont on ne peut plus se passer. On lui doit des outils de travail de référence, je pense au Consuls of the Later Roman Empire, à son Chronological Systems of Byzantine Egypt ou à l'Oxford Handbook of Papyrology. Et surtout, il a contribué, je crois que c'est ce qui est le plus important, à faire rentrer la papyrologie dans une autre ère, celle de l'Internet, notamment s'engageant dans le développement d'APIS, APIS, Advanced Papyrological Information Systems, ce réseau informatisé des collections papyrologiques qui a été un formidable moteur dans la mise en ligne des collections papyrologiques, pas simplement américaines, mais ensuite du monde entier. Sans laquelle, vous le savez, notre travail serait aujourd'hui non seulement ralenti dans son rythme, mais aussi, je dirais, retréci ou limité dans ses résultats. Bref, sans tomber ou sans sombrer dans la rhétorique encomiastique, force est de constater que dans le champ des études papyrologiques, eh bien, il y a un avant et un après Bagnall, et que, quel que soit le sujet que l'on traite ou les instrumenta auxquels on a recours, eh bien, il est désormais très difficile d'échapper à Bagnall. C'est pour cela que, et je m'adresse là encore aux jeunes qui sont ici, vous avez beaucoup de chance de pouvoir aujourd'hui mettre un visage, et dans quelques secondes aussi une voix, sur ce nom que vous avez rencontré et que vous aurez l'occasion de rencontrer encore très souvent. Roger, encore merci d'être là et je vous donne la parole.
Merci. Thank you very much for that generous introduction. It is wonderful to be here at last, and indeed to be back in Paris for the first time in quite a while. Even if my telephone tells me that the air quality is poor today, and on that I will blame all of the coughing that I may do. I want first to apologize for speaking in English throughout these lectures. There were two reasons for this, apart from its being easier. First, a sense that the international web audience for the recorded version of these lectures would find it easier. And second, as I shall explain, there is a sense in which management as an idea is rather peculiarly a product of the Anglophone world. These four lectures will be devoted to the question of how the complex economy, both public and private, of Roman and late antique Egypt was managed. My main focus in the following three lectures will be on the managers themselves. Who were they? How were they formed as managers? And what did they do? But such an investigation presupposes a description of what it was that they were going to manage. What was the nature and scale of the economy? And how was the labor force of Egypt deployed in support of this economic activity? This is obviously a vast subject on which much has been written, and is part, moreover, of a larger debate over the nature of the ancient economy in general. A debate that by now, I think, has moved beyond the simplistic primitivists versus modernists framework that was once commonplace, indeed not so long ago. But I shall have to limit myself to sketching the situation as I see it without the time to defend my choices in any detail, which may come as a relief. There are many things about which we know quite a lot, others about which we know next to nothing. Much of this will seem obvious to specialists, but I do not think anyone has actually tried to put numbers on these things before. But even before that, I have to say what I mean by managing, and manager, and management. It is striking how rarely the general concept figures in the literature of papyrology. For example, a search in the Bibliographie Papyrologique for manager yields just 7 results, 2 of them connected to the small book of Willy Clarisse and Katelijn van Dorpe about Zenon, the first version of which used the English manager in the Dutch title. That already tells you something. The French version rendered this as homme d'affaires, a phrase that in English would normally be translated businessman. French dictionaries tell us that manage and its derivatives may be rendered with diriger, administrer, or gérer, and their derivatives. The difficulty may be seen in the diversity of names given to business schools in France, mostly using English language names with the word business, but some in French with commerce, or commerce, or management, indeed, the latter obviously seen as a loan word. Only one uses the term gestion, which it seems to me would be the most general term. And therein lies the nub of the problem. The term management in the names of business schools in the United States has been chosen, whether explicitly, as is true in some cases, or implicitly, to assert that the skills needed in business are not fundamentally different from those required for managing nonprofit organizations or public entities. An activity perhaps more normally described in both English and French, administration. That claim by the business schools, of course, enlarges the potential pool of customers for these schools, giving them financial resources that other parts of the universities can only envy. But oddly enough, their claim seems to me correct in the case of Roman Egypt. With the porousness of the boundaries between public and private activities, and, as I hope to show, between the skills needed in these spheres. It is for this reason that I have adopted the more abstract concept of manage and manager. This also has the advantage of not being limited, as I think perhaps a word like diriger might suggest, to the highest levels of management. It should be noted, by the way, that the terms management and manager in English are themselves of no great antiquity, dating only to the late 16th century, when they began to compete with administration and stewardship in describing the activity in question. So abstracting and generalizing the idea of management is not of any great antiquity. The other results in my bibliographic search included 3 references to estate managers, 1 to a manager of the Graphéon at Caranis, and a citation of the book of Jean-Jacques Aubert on business managers in ancient Rome, a book that focuses on Italy and explicitly excludes Egypt from its purview, apart from a couple of pages. It has, moreover, a subtitle that suggests another dimension to the problem. Quote, a social and economic study of institores, 200 BC to AD 250. Although Aubert's focus on the importance of managers is useful, his focus is strongly legal, He argues that the classic Roman villa organization of Italian agriculture was the central driver of this model of organization, which is, moreover, based on slave and freedman personnel, something that in my view plays a much less important role in Egypt, particularly in agriculture. A search in the Bibliographie Papyrologique on management turns up a somewhat larger universe, which includes state administration, water management, the direction of monasteries, and even risk management, among other subjects. But only to a limited degree does this literature help bring out the figure of the manager, and thus give a sense of how management was carried out. Perhaps the most obviously relevant book is Dennis Kehoe's, the second on this slide, which was published in 1992. This book will come back into our investigations of some specific managers. But the most striking aspect of this book is its very tight top-down focus on the owners of land and their strategies for extracting an income from their properties. The actual nature and operations of the managers employed by these landowners receive comparatively little attention. Toward the other end of our time period, there is an illuminating analysis of the layers of management of imperial estates in the 5th and 6th century in Azzarello's book, the third item here. This contributes importantly to the discussion of terminology in my third lecture, but it is aimed at elucidating the hierarchy and relative responsibilities of these managers, and at comparing the imperial structures to those of the estates of the Appian family, not looking at their formation or indeed their daily activities. The most important treatment of managers in Roman Egypt, curiously enough, did not turn up in such a bibliographic search. This is, of course, the last item on the slide, Dominic Rathbone's fundamental book on the Appianus estate and the archive of Herodotus. This rich study will provide material for all of these lectures, particularly the third and the fourth. But the estates of Appianus and related figures in this archive illuminate only one end of the spectrum of management of private landed wealth. And one of my purposes is to provide a wider context for the models that we see at work in the Herodotus papers. These lectures will not only be about the economy, they will also, equally importantly, be about an aspect of the written culture of Roman and Byzantine Egypt. This is the case partly and superficially, because it is above all from the documentary sources that we gain insights into management. But at a deeper level, our investigation is about the relationship of writing and management. Dealing with questions such as what kind of management required writing and why, how the use of writing shaped management, and what kinds of people became managers. These issues will surface repeatedly in the three following lectures. Rich as Egypt is in documentation, compared to almost any other part of the ancient world, it does not offer us the statistical information we would need to give an accurate and detailed picture of the economy, with a full depiction of production, consumption, capital, and labor. Even less are we in a position to describe quantitatively how that economy changed over time. Economic historians have, for the most part, built models based on information gathered over a wide span of time, from the 1st century to the 6th, but particularly from the 2nd to the 4th centuries. It is, of course, hard to imagine that the Antonine Plague, the multiple disruptions of the 3rd century, and the reforms of Diocletian, just to mention three important impulses, did not cause significant fluctuation in the population and in productivity. For my purposes here, however, such variability is not of central importance, as I do not see any reason to believe that it would have affected the character of the economy or the structures of management very much. That is not to say, however, that the evolution of the economy over the centuries did not change the needs and opportunities for management and the use of writing in management and in education. I believe that it did. I shall return to this question after giving a relatively static and positivistic description of the economy. I shall therefore be relying on a model of the sort I mentioned, recognizing that it contains multiple and cumulative estimates, and even guesses, which make any statements highly approximate. I've built on the essentials of the model for land and cities recently presented by Luc de Ligt. This rests on a long history of study by many other scholars of the bits of evidence at our disposition, but also on four important innovations. First, de Ligt has created the first detailed attempt to assess the size of the nomes of the delta in the Roman period, remarkably enough. Second, he has restudied the sizes of Upper Egyptian nomes. Third, he's gathered a lot more information for the surface areas occupied by the cities of Egypt, mainly the nome capitals, than anybody has done before. And fourth, in calculating the areas of the nomes, he has adjusted the figures for the percentage of land that was probably under cultivation and the relative fertility of different regions, based largely on evidence from the 19th and early 20th centuries. In a recent article, he has extended this study of the early modern evidence to support an estimate for both cultivable land and population in the early Roman period. There are the main elements. Now, the model has many vulnerabilities, as de Ligt himself acknowledges, particularly with respect to the percentage of land used for various types of cultivation. But these do not seriously impair its usefulness for our purposes. And in any case, I have modified it here and there where I thought it was needed. He describes an Egypt of some 28,000 square kilometers, maybe a bit more, roughly 24,000 of which were under cultivation. Of that, I suppose about 80% was in grain or similar field crops, 8 to 12% in garden and orchard crops, vineyards and olive groves and things like that. The remainder used for other purposes or simply uncultivated at any given time. In this Egypt, there were 53 cities, 21 nome capitals in Upper Egypt, 28 in Lower Egypt, and three Greek cities besides Ptolemais, Alexandria, Pelusium. The Western Oasis and Paraetonian account for another four or five cities. De Ligt's models focused around AD 235, but I think it was probably not much different from what we would see in the fourth century also. If you exclude Alexandria, these cities had average sizes of about 70 hectares and 16,000 people, but that probably had a considerable dispersion, and this logarithmic graph that de Ligt published gives you some idea of the distribution, which suggests that there were a few rather large cities like Arsinoe, Ptolemais, Memphis, and Hermopolis, far more medium to medium small, and hardly any very small ones. But if Alexandria's population was around 400,000, the urban population as a whole should have amounted to about 1.2 to 1.3 million, which would have been 22 to 24% of the total population if we use 5.5 million as a conservative estimate. De Ligt gives a range of population estimates over time and prefers 6 million, but even so, the urban population would have been about 20 to 22%, which is a very, very high figure for the pre-modern world, something that's important for thinking about society's needs for management. The countryside was, of course, organized into these nomes, the territories of the metropolis, as we would properly call them after the municipal reforms of Septimius Severus. Although, of course, the terminology of the nomes persisted past the Arab conquest. These in turn were divided into villages, of which there were probably somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500. The land belonging to these villages was owned partly by urban residents, partly by villagers. To judge from the Hermopolite land registers of the mid-4th century, only about 13 or 14% of urban households owned any land at all. Perhaps 35% of rural households. Most of the remaining villagers worked in agriculture, as tenants, or as hired labor. Constraints of time and distance in getting out to the fields make it unlikely that much of the urban population worked in the agriculture, although some may have worked in the intensive cultivation that surrounded the cities. Some of the urban landowners may have worked their holdings directly, as most of them owned relatively small amounts. But perhaps 200 families in a large city on the scale of Hermopolis had enough land that this was inherently not feasible, particularly as the land holdings were typically dispersed rather than consolidated. They needed agents and managers. Extrapolated to the country as a whole, Hermopolis was an unusually large nome. That means about 5,000 managers of estates at a minimum. And larger estates surely needed more than one. Even some owners of smaller estates will, for various reasons, have needed a manager, particularly if they were far away from their land and didn't want to manage it on a daily basis. This may have been particularly true of women with medium-sized or even small landholdings. Some villagers will also have needed managers, because village land was not equally distributed, and some of the wealthier village residents had holdings in multiple villages. These were no doubt a very small percentage of the whole, but if there were nearly 900,000 village households in the country, a little over 300,000 of them owning land, even if 2% of landholders needed agents, we would need another 6,000 or so managers. It's thus hard to suppose that there were fewer than 10,000 such managers across the entire province, and this may be a significant underestimate. This doesn't, of course, mean that all of them worked as managers full time. Such a general statement, however, colorless it may seem, may conceal important changes. Even taking account of the growth in the total numbers of published papyri, which peak in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, the use of the two main terms for state managers, phrontistes and pronoetes, grows strikingly over the Roman centuries. It's something I will come back to in the third lecture. These terms are hardly attested in the 1st century, when pronoetes essentially is not found at all. Phrontistes is rare in the 1st century, BC in the 1st century AD, becomes commoner in the 2nd century and better attested in the 3rd, while pronoetes begins to be better attested after 250 and comes to dominate the late antique documentation. Of course, there are numerous archival finds that affect these numbers, and that's why I don't weary you here with pseudo-statistics. I shall give a bit more detail later. But despite all reservations, it looks as if there is a rise in professionalism, marked by specific agent nouns used to identify the roles of these men. Now, large estates involved much more than farming labor devoted to planting, tilling, and harvesting. Agriculture might require the management of water sources, whether of the flood water or of water drawn by machinery. security for crops, for threshing floors, for oil and winemaking production, and storage facilities, all of which required guards. These were presumably all ultimately under the direction of estate managers, but it is certain that at least in some cases there were foremen supervising these workers and in turn reporting to the estate managers. At the same time, partly for this reason, we have to recognize that estate management was not always a flat structure, as it is called in management speak, but a hierarchical one. Frontistae and pronoetae in the larger estates were in charge of units, mostly based on geographical locations or areas, and they reported to higher level managers. The ultimate development of this differentiation can be seen in the administration of imperial estates, as I mentioned earlier, where we can elucidate a multi-tier hierarchy. In the third lecture, I will come back to this and try to show how those hierarchies were developing earlier. Late antique Egyptian cities and villages were also the homes of workers in fields other than agriculture. Some of them also owned land, and these tend to be better documented than the others because they appear in tax registers and other texts more frequently. Because late antique tax registers, after Diocletian, are overwhelmingly connected with taxes based on property rather than on heads of people, these registers disproportionately record landowners. The diversity of such trades was undoubtedly proportional to the size of the village. In the case of a large settlement, such as Aphrodite, the list of crafts and trades described in the papyri and recently analyzed by Giovanni Ruffini is very large. But the repertory was far smaller in a more shrunken village on the scale of late antique Karanis, where even in the prosperous second century, non-agricultural workers were only some 6% of the labor force. The lists vary from place to place, but they are consistently dominated by food processing, construction, and textiles. From the 6th century tax register from the good-sized Hermopolite village of Temsos Gordon, we find 10 men in food processing and preparation, 12 in construction, at least 9 in fabric and clothing, 5 smiths, and 5 service occupations. 2 soldiers, if you call that service, a grain measurer, a doctor, and a scribe or a teacher. Then the church accounts for a priest, 2 deacons, 2 readers, and 1 manager, and a few monastics. All in all, about a sixth of the taxpayers seem to have some sort of occupation other than farmer. But again, we have to keep in mind that the tax register lists people who owned land, and there must have been more people who were in these occupations who didn't own land. Some of them, at least in the cities, were salaried employees. The phenomenon of the employment of free persons in jobs bearing wages or salaries has recently been studied in detail by Christelle Freux in her excellent habilitation thesis, which has just been published as a book. She shows just how complex a mix of independent craftsmen, apprentices, family members, slaves, and salaried workers there was in the urban production environment. In villages, the craft workers were generally in small enterprises, only an individual or a family for the most part. It is unlikely that village enterprises would have required professional management by anyone not directly involved in the craft in question. But at least in larger villages, many of the trades had guilds representing them in dealing with higher authorities, and these must have created some degree of managerial work. The situation in the cities was very different, but also highly variable and hard to measure. There is good evidence, for example, of a high volume of textile production in Oxyrhynchus in the 3rd century, but we cannot say with any confidence how widespread such a scale was. My strong suspicion, but it is only that, is that the size and complexity of urban production enterprises were distributed in a fashion similar to that of the sizes of urban populations. the concentration of large and complex organizations in the larger cities. Above all, of course, Alexandria, but also Memphis and the larger Nome capitals. The large group of medium-sized Nome capitals were probably less complex than the big ones by a factor larger than the simple arithmetical relationship of their populations. If this is correct, we should suppose that the larger the city, the higher the proportion of the population needed for managerial roles in production would be. But I do not know what kind of factor to apply in such a computation. The papyri also preserve an enormous number of names of specialized sellers of goods, both foodstuffs and craft products. This is also true, although in a less concentrated fashion, of the epigraphical record of other regions of the Roman world. So I don't think Egypt was unusual. But we are particularly richly informed in Egypt by the price declarations of guilds of retailers from late antique Oxyrhynchus. And the documentation in general is abundant enough to have attracted scholars to the relatively boring task of compiling lists of these trades. But it's almost never possible to say how many lentil sellers there were in a given city, let's say. So these lists are of little structural significance, other than to point to a highly developed level of specialization. We are still less well informed about the wholesale markets that aggregated production and shipped it from the place of production to other places of sale. We know that such merchants existed, sometimes referred to as pragmatauti, but also by other terms, but they are not well documented in the surviving texts. The poverty of the Alexandrian documentation is at the heart of this gap, as the capital certainly drew products from all over Egypt in large quantities. But the network of commerce was much more than that, as we shall see from the private letters about getting and sending, which are analyzed in detail by Patrick Reinhard. These, again, don't offer any real opening for quantification. But all selling and distribution certainly involved record keeping. For the retailers, we have little information, and there is reason to believe that many of them were not literate. So indeed, they regularly tell us in their price declarations, possibly not always truthfully. They may have operated largely on a cash basis and without elaborate accounts. But the requirements of government declarations in late antiquity may have caused a higher level of formalization in the organization of such small enterprises, and the need at least for someone in the administration of the guilds to keep track of prices and prepare and submit the declarations every month. In larger enterprises managing substantial quantities of goods, accounting was not optional. How far merchants did this work themselves and how far they needed to employ clerks to keep track of their purchases and sales, we have no way to say. The demand for the skills involved in the management of all of this work must have been considerable, even if the merchants carried out this work for themselves in many cases. We should not, by the way, assume that all of these managers of family businesses were men. Even apart from the likelihood of being widowed, women played an important role in managing affairs when men were away on their country estates, just as they often ran the country estates when men were in the cities. Now, turn to public administration. We must think about three levels of administration when we think about the needs for trained manpower. First is the imperial administration. For the beginning of the 5th century, Bernhard Palma has estimated that the number of officials in all of the offices of the provincial governors will have been about 2,000. We have no way of estimating how many lower-level employees with some managerial skills there may have been outside the ranks of these officiales. But it is clear that at this level, the size of the administration was in any case very small by modern standards, as has often been observed. Nevertheless, every year, a fair number of officials must have been recruited. The documents give us an impression of near constant change in the liturgical administration of the metropolis and villages over the centuries. Some of this is illusory, no doubt, but as taxation changed, so did the structures in charge of it. Even so, the functions mostly remained across all of this change of titles and even of legal structures. If we look at the situation in the 4th century, the metropolis show a number of sometimes overlapping liturgical positions connected with taxation. The apaitetai, apodectai, diadotai, epimeletai, hypodectai. They were supervised at the nome level by the logistes and the exactor, and at the pagus level by the praepositus pagi. The bibliotheca enctaseon was still functioning through at least the 2nd decade of the 4th century, keeping records of transactions concerning land. The philarchi and the systati handled other public records. Public order involved the erinarches and the nyctostrategoi, later the riparius. The classic civic institutions were still represented by the prytanist, the gymnasiarch, and the cosmetes, perhaps also the exegetes and even the agoronomos. As we will see later, the gymnasiarchs needed a manager. There was a public banker. Records of agricultural land needed to be maintained, and a network of dikes and canals was supervised forever, requiring the management of a large number of temporary workers. Now, most of the positions I've mentioned were held by members of the municipal elite, sometimes in colleges of 2 to 5 office holders. Many of them were restricted to city councilors, but in any case, substantial assets were required for eligibility. Those assets were, of course, landed wealth, and the men who owned these estates thus had significant managerial challenges already on the private front, to which public duties only added. It is clear from a variety of documents, including tax receipts, registers, and correspondence, that the holders of liturgical positions employed men to do the actual work of collecting taxes, keeping records, and supervising compulsory labor. These employees signed on behalf of their employers, often without indicating so. Now, in no case do we have the evidence to say exactly how many liturgical office holders there were in a metropolis in a given year, but I don't see how it could have been less than 35. And their total staffing can hardly have been less than 100. The numbers may have been a little more in large nomes, a little less in small nomes, but most of these tasks had to be carried out no matter how large or how small the city was. A minimum of about 5,000 such employees for Egypt as a whole seems necessary, and in larger nomes, the challenges of tax collection must have required more. We know, for example, from the Tempsos-Gordone Codex that the tax collector visited the village and its dependent hamlet Topos Demeu at least 20 times during the indiction year. As the Hermopolite nome had something like 100 villages, it is easy to see that the number of person days of work for the nome would have been substantial. At the village level, liturgical offices were somewhat fewer, but many of them involved multiple holders each year. There will have been at least, given on the period, the comarchs at the top of the pyramid, with presbyteroi, sitologoi, the quadrarius, the tesserarius, all of them involved in taxation. If you add police officials and the still ill-understood kephaliotai, you have to reckon with about 15 to 20 such officials. In smaller villages and even mid-sized ones, the burden on the class of well-off villagers was substantial. We can see its workings in the frequency with which Aurelius Isidorus held office, pretty much every other year. We know that many of these men would not have been literate, even among the wealthier, so performing the extensive paperwork responsibilities of the positions was not an option for them. Their secretaries and assistants can hardly have been fewer than 20 per village. And if so, that means, let's say, 45,000 or even 50,000 for Egypt as a whole. It's a lot of people. Even without the graphea that were a feature of villages earlier in the Roman period, the volume of local records to be compiled and transmitted to higher officials must have been large. We should also take into account the fact that the administration of taxes involved not only the public officials of a given year, but those who coordinated the payments to them. We have a number of accounts, for example, giving the assessments of various members of a pitakion, or unit of taxation. Someone had to draw up such assessments and administer the collection and delivery of the amounts on them. Again, not all of this work involved writing, but some of it did. The considerable changes in the governance of the cities in the 5th and 6th centuries altered the long-standing liturgical system very considerably, and few of these offices survived. But the work they did was not eliminated. As public duties were taken over to a large degree by the so-called fiscal shares, most of this labor and its managing must have moved with them into the hands of the pronoetae and those working for them. Services. Although services in general were not as large a part of the ancient economy as they are today, the relatively low cost of labor and the undeveloped state of technology meant that they were far from negligible. Frew's book has shown just how many of such roles there were. Many represent unskilled labor, and in most cases, probably the only management at stake was in the household or the shop. Only the largest and wealthiest households would have needed managers to deal with their domestic servants or nurses. But the bath certainly employed a significant workforce, and somebody had to manage it. Also largely missing from our documentation are the staffs of other public activities and facilities. The postal service, policing, public water supply, markets, gymnasia, rental properties owned by the cities, and so forth. Who supervised them? It is very difficult to get any real sense of the numbers of these workers or of the structure of their workplaces. The only area outside those already discussed for which we can make any guess at administrative staff in late antiquity is the church. There's not much evidence for administrative staff in village churches, which had small numbers of clergy, few of them full-time themselves, and few assets other than the building and its furnishings. This is the one area in which late antiquity may have seen a reduction in administrative staff, at least temporarily, as the temples of the earlier centuries certainly involved more management, if only to comply with regulatory demands. In the metropolis, matters were different. The seats of the bishops certainly had not only oikonomoi, or chief stewards, but some subordinates for keeping track of revenues, expenses, and assets, as well as supporting the bishop in his burden of correspondence. But it would be hard in the 4th century to imagine that this body of administrators amounted to more than about 500 for Egypt as a whole, apart from the Patriarchate. Other metropolitan churches may also have had some administrative staff. Much harder to assess is the world of monasteries. These in many ways functioned as patrimonial structures, both in their familial ideology and in their resemblance to private estates. Few elements in the demand for administration can have changed as much from the 4th century to the 6th or 7th as monastic estates did. In the early 4th century, such estates were a negligible factor, but 200 years later, large amounts of land were in the hands of monasteries. And of course, monasteries had other types of administration besides agricultural and financial, not least the correspondence of the abbots, but also keeping rosters of the monks or nuns, of whatever library the establishment possessed, and dealing with the government. Finally, it is hard to avoid supposing that wealthy households employed managers not only for their tax collection responsibilities and for their land holdings around a nome, but also for the administration of their urban households, even if this was true only of a few. Even with all of the approximations and blanks in the discussion so far, and with the recognition that we are no doubt missing entirely some service sectors that required administration, the numbers are substantial. We may reasonably suppose that the total number of managerial staff on our broad definition was somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 or even more across all of Egypt. Bearing in mind that I've hardly tried to guess at numbers for Alexandria, this would amount to something like 6% of the male workforce between the ages of 14 and 65. Such a figure would be consistent with Christel Freux's estimate that around 20% of the Egyptian workforce received a salary or wages. Not all managers were managing staff, of course, and some managed staff may not have been salaried. But given Egyptian death rates and the possibility of loss of personnel for other reasons, perhaps 3,000 to 4,000 new administrators needed to be recruited each year. Their formation will occupy us in the second lecture. I've already mentioned the increased use of terms for managers during the centuries of Roman rule. There are reasons to believe that this is no accident in our documentation or mere fashion of vocabulary. The most fundamental of these is surely the gradual increase in the concentration of landed wealth and political and administrative power in the hands of a limited circle of the wealthy. The growing landholdings of the governing class created a steadily rising need for suitable individuals to manage these holdings, as they surpassed what an individual could take care of and still, of course, have leisure for the public roles to which their wealth qualified them. I'll come back to this point in the final lecture. The process will have been intensified by the rising investment of capital in these larger properties. Freux has called attention to the tendency of capital investment to lead for specialized and typically salaried employees to operate the facilities created with this capital. It follows, I think, that this increased staff will have strengthened the pressure for competent supervision as well as for accounting. Indeed, it appears that the sophistication of accounting rises steadily through this period as well. Wealthy landowners investing capital had stronger incentives to demand to see what the results of their investments were. Here again, I would agree with Freux's assessment that direct management of properties led to a greater demand for sophisticated accounting. We can see the tendency toward abstract analysis of the use of inputs beginning in the late first century and accelerating in the second, and even more in the third century, as do terms like ergatai for man days of labor, which come into wider use. It is no accident that we find the greatest abstraction to date and the most analytic approach in the accounts of Herodotus, as Dominic Rathbone showed. And proper accountability for local estate managers required more activist management from above on the part of stewards capable of reading the accounts and knowing how to interpret them in the light of the landowner's interests. A lower level manager might get by with fairly simple ledgers of income and expense, but these will not have given his superiors the information they really needed. One might think the change would have been less in the public sphere, but I don't think this was so. As the liturgical system became ever more widespread and encompassed more of the activities required by the government, the liturgists will have felt the same kind of need to control the activities of those they employed to carry out their duties of collection and supervision. This is hardly surprising, since they were, after all, largely the same people as those who needed assistance in managing their estates. But there's another less clearly demonstrable area of growth, that of civic activities. As the cities gained administrative autonomy over the course of the second century, and then still more from Severus on, they did not merely take on duties performed by someone else earlier. They increased what the cities did. The great growth in building activity that seems to have followed the Severan reforms will have provided new facilities to be managed and probably new services as well. Some of this no doubt declined after the 4th century, but the wealth and energies were almost certainly just redirected, in many cases into charitable institutions under the control of churches or monasteries. These too, as we have seen, required management. Management was not new in Rome and Egypt, of course, but the evidence suggests to me that it was not only quantitatively but qualitatively different from what we find in Ptolemaic times. There's a strongly Roman stamp on the entire enterprise, a view I shall defend in more detail in the 3rd and 4th lectures. So far, I've made 2 central arguments. The first is that the economy of Roman Egypt, both private and political, required a substantial number of managers. These can be seen hierarchically, ranging from high-level stewards and administrators down to field supervisors of operations. The second is that the need for management grew throughout the Roman and late antique periods. The central driver for this process was the increasing concentration of land and wealth and power in the hands of a city-based upper class and eventually the institutions of the church. That process not only led to more vertical articulation of society, directly making the need for management more critical, it also resulted in greater investment and a greater use of salaried labor, both of which complicated the economy and required more management. And it centralized much activity in the Nome capitals, directing more resources into a more highly managed environment and away from a village society of independent farmers, which required less. Over a very long trajectory, this process moved the needed managers to some degree from public employment under the Ptolemies into private hands. To get beyond such generalities, the next 3 lectures will be devoted to 3 topics. In the 2nd, I shall consider the preparation of young men for careers in management. Even if there was no such generalized concept as management in everyday use, the people who carried out these responsibilities needed certain skills. What were these skills? How far did the educational system provide them? Here we can base ourselves not only on the extensive work on ancient education carried out in the past 1/4 century, but on newly published and forthcoming texts from the schools. The 3rd lecture will try to identify managers in the written record. Some of this identification is relatively straightforward because of the use of titles. But there are other approaches that deserve consideration also. Who, for example, writes contracts on behalf of landlords or lenders? Can we find characteristic traits in handwriting? We also need to investigate who does the accounting for various enterprises and who carries out correspondence. How far are managers their own secretaries? Do they use what has been termed scribes? And who are the managers? What legal and social status do they have? In the final lecture, I plan to look more closely at managers at work, looking at some case studies that illuminate various aspects of their activity. I shall ask what value they actually added to society and economy, if any. In particular, I look at the nexus of writing and management that lies at the core of their activities, particularly at the higher levels. I shall conclude with some reflections on the essential role played by managers and their writing in making the political and social structures of the late Roman world possible. Thank you.